Hello, you're listening to Spotlight on Travel with John Costa and with Rob Watson. And today's programme, we're going to be talking about a recent trip to India that I made and catching up with Rob again, maybe some deeper reflections on his time in Japan and also my trips last year to Nigeria. So, Rob, how's things with you?
Very well, thanks, John.
Cool. Now, we often mention the weather. I remember at the very first times we started doing Spotlight on Art and Spotlight on Heritage, we were talking about how warm and sunny it was, but we're in the sort of cold, dark reality of a January in
the UK.
Leicester.
Yeah. It's grim.
It is. I was watching something the other day with Monty Don, the quite famous gardener off the television, and he was talking about, it's on the iPlayer, so I recommend anybody watches it. And it's about gardens in the Rhineland. And he follows the Rhine from its source all the way through to the sea. And the interesting thing about it is when I was looking at his biography online, and it was saying he's actually affected by SADS, you know, the seasonal...
adjustment disorder.
It's really quite bad, actually. It gets quite bad about it.
Yeah, my desk at home, I put daylight corrected lights everywhere. So before Christmas, I was feeling really kind of touchy. Mm. And my mum said, are you using your daylight lights? And I thought, no, I'm not. Because it feels nice and warm and comforting to sit with the incandescent orangey kind of lights. And you think, oh, it's a nice comfort thing. But it grinds you down. And I learned that the difference. I worked at it was Virgin Megastore many years ago, and I worked in the cash office, so I was counting money all day. And it had grey, what was it, 25% grey walls and daylight corrected fluorescent light. And I walked out in the evening, this is Christmas time, walked out every evening feeling like it was a spring day. Mm. And it was like, oh yeah, it does. I mean, you don't want to go
really
to sleep.
It does really affect you. Yeah.
It does. And so turn them off in the evening, because otherwise it keeps you wired and awake all evening. But you know, using coffee and daylight corrected lights kind of is what gets me through the winter months.
Yeah, and I guess this is one of the things that we don't really think about, do we, with travel as well. You know, I mean, a lot of people travel for holiday and leisure. Pleasure, I guess. And then, you know, my Nigeria trips were work. My India trip recently was volunteering with an NGO about a longer heritage project. So it's kind of work, if you like. But you forget about the fact that you're not on holiday and you're not really relaxing in that way. And so coming back, I really felt it this week. I feel like I'm really sort of tired and I need to catch up.
I don't think that's you.
Yeah.
I think it's the time of year. It's the weather. You know, it's our age, you know, all those kind of things. It just kind of, it just feels like you've been squeezed through the toothpaste tube and you've just got to kind of go, right, be kind to yourself and just get through it. Do some comfort reading, some comfort movies and stuff, and just get through that part. This is the hardest part of the year. And then one of the things you do notice at the moment is that we were out yesterday. I had a trip to London on Wednesday, and after the meeting I was out in the morning, we went for a walk around the city and explored a little bit around there, and you just felt, oh, it's 1 o'clock in the afternoon. It's like the sun just feels that bit higher, and it's not getting the dark now. It's getting dark 4:30.
We've turned the corner, haven't we?
And you feel it, yeah. And you're getting up in the morning, and you're going, oh, it's that. You see the dawn. So we got the coach down. So we got the Flixbus coach down 6 a.m. from Leicester to London. You know, do it as cheap as we could, and you're in the darkness for, and then 7:30, you're starting to see the dawn come through, and then it gets more pronounced much more quickly. Whereas before, it was like you'd see the dawn at 8 a.m. It's just. The cycle of the seasons in the Northern Hemisphere. But
it's quite good, isn't it? Because I think for a long time, I felt quite guilty thinking about travelling and stuff because of climate change. There was a lot of guilt put on you if you went on a plane and all that sort of stuff. Whereas actually getting back on a plane and then thinking about why you're travelling and what you're doing and what the point is, I don't feel as guilty as I used to. I felt about six, 7 years ago, there was a real kind of guilt that came with travelling.
Well, you're not going to put the genie back in the bottle, and it's changed our society so fundamentally that it's very difficult to roll it backwards. But also there is a great benefit of it as well, and it's kind of like we forget. You know, the danger is that we admonish ourselves. Yes, we need to deal with the carbon emissions, but the biggest factor in global warming is Chinese power plants, you know. So which one is it we're going to choose? Do we stop traveling because you know, China's now going through a phase of building nuclear power stations. It's got 30 on the go at the moment, whereas the United States has got none. So, you know, pick and choose your policy response. But as an individual, you know, get the benefits of the world. Yeah, you're leaving a challenge for the people of tomorrow, the next generations. But it was always thus.
So, Rob, reflecting back on Japan now after a couple of months of being back, what's your overriding memory you've got over the tiredness and stuff thinking back?
Oh gosh, I'd love to go back again as soon as
you
can.
So you're interested in being drawn back.
And I think I've got to go and do some work there, and to do some learning there, because it is a different social and cultural model. It was interesting. I was listening to a podcast the other evening, and this author was saying that he was traveling around, and they're making a documentary film or something, and they were in Japan. And a member of his team, they're Americans, and a member of the documentary crew was saying, you know, Japanese people are a minority, and he said, "You're in Japan,
not in Japan.
It's the majority, you know." And it's like, you know, that kind of shift of perspective points, the point where you're looking at things is incredibly, and you can only experience that. You can watch as many videos online, travel documentaries. But you've got to experience that. You only realise that shift in the pivot point. We, as Westerners, have a certain point that we think that things... Archimedean point that we think that things revolve around, and where we can shift and move things around. Well, it's different in the Far East. It's different in South Asia. It's different in Africa. It's different in the Americas. You know, there's different pivot points that people move around. And to make that assumption that you've only... We get great benefits out of where... that point is for us. It's brought us technological change, science, you know, we can fly to the moon, we can, you know, talking about curing cancer, all those kind of things, which other societies' pivot points haven't enabled them to do in the way yet. So it's like, so we've got to value that, but at the same time recognise that it's not the only perspective that you're going to get on problems and challenges and global issues.
Yeah, you can read and you can watch things and you can talk to people, but, you know, just going there and standing and, you know, sitting in a coffee shop and observing what goes on. I always remember when we were back in Cambodia back in 2018, and, you know, I'm not sure we were waiting to go into Chul Sling S21, the genocide museum, or whether we'd come out. But I remember, or maybe it was the next day after we'd done one trip, but just sitting there, the world looked slightly different because you knew what had gone on in that building. Yeah, it must have been the following day, and we'd walked around, and then to sit there in that coffee shop watching the world go by, but looking at that building, knowing what it was for, it kind of slightly changed the perspective on kind of the travelling, which you wouldn't have got from just watching a documentary or just reading a book.
We've got a street in Leicester called Gallow Tree Gate, and what does that refer to? It refers to where public hangings and executions used to take place. It's just, it's like everywhere's got them, and it's like that historical reference point kind of gets a bit lost, and it gets a bit sanitised, and it gets a bit washed out, and you don't see that kind of level of, you know, in Cambodia it's much closer, and lots of other places it's much closer to the surface. It's in recent memory, whereas, you know, for us in the UK it's perhaps a more distant memory. It's intergenerational memory, which gets more diffused. I was going to ask you a question about in between travels. So I want to find out a little bit more about your recent trip to India, and you can tell us some of the adventures that you had there. But in between, in terms of where you get your, because you're an explorer type, you like travel. What do you do? Reading, National Geographic, YouTube, yeah, what's your main...
Yeah, definitely.
Where do you draw inspiration from?
I think I started back just before lockdown with a collection of items, and then during lockdown that kind of gave me the time to start indexing it all on cards. And then when I came up with the sort of documentary media concept of film, photography, audio, new media, it was a way of starting to curate, if you like, what I'd collected. So then when I started thinking about people, places and events, that solutions journalism, then what it means then is I've always got I've got an archive on each of the 120 countries of the Global South that I tend to cover through the Parallel Lives Network, and so I can always pull out a a pile of something. You know, there's digital assets online and listed resources on a YouTube playlist, but most of the time it's documentaries I've acquired, books, National Geographics, maps, money. I always get copies of newspapers, even if it's in the, you know, the local language and the English version. And what it does is it just allows you to think about. I'm always thinking about how I would put an exhibition on for someone about what they're going to find when they go. So not instead of going, come and, you know, here's a pile of stuff that I recommend you then go and see and engage with.
Yeah, I was going to say kind of the collection of train tickets and, you know, I mean, it's, a lot of it's becoming digital these days, so you know it might be virtual, but you grab an images of, I mean, things like coffee cups and you know, it's just the, I mean, I kind of tend to do that with sound is one of the forgotten things that we collect.
It's interesting you mentioned sound, because for me, you know, I remember when I got to Mumbai over 3 weeks ago now, and we got to the first road junction and I got my phone out, and my first instinct wasn't to take a photograph, it was just to record that junction for like a couple of minutes. And the guy was like, oh, you know, what are you recording? And I said, I'm just recording the junction, because we've got footage like that when we went to Phnom Penh in Cambodia. I've got footage from Abuja in Nigeria last year a couple of times. And it was just that reflection of society. So, you know, you've got the countdown, sort of, you know, 90 seconds to go for the traffic lights, which we don't have in the UK. Traffic lights that count down, it's interesting. And so you've got all this traffic going from left to right, crazy. And then you've got people walking. So you've got like mums, dads, you know, people going to work, young people, people running, people bimbling, you know, people with disabilities. You've got all of these different things. And as the all the traffic that goes past, buses, tuk-tuks, and then as it gets down to sort of 5, 4, 3, you see everything start to move both sides of the junctions. People start running, and then it's like 1, and then everybody goes like a Formula One race, and then there's still people crossing the road, and you see like the whites of their eyes as they get terrified, and then you'll get halfway across the junction, and then a tuk-tuk, a motorbike, and a bus will still come across the junction, and then it's absolute chaos and honking and all that, and then you get to the other side, it's like, how am I even alive? But for me, that 90-second, two-minute thing sums up what life is about, which is there's order and everyone's going about their place, and then all of a sudden there's these moments of heightened stress, running out of time, and I've still got to get across the road, but I know I shouldn't go because the lights are changing, but I still need to go. And it kind of sums up society, really. So a combination of sitting outside a coffee shop observing, and then also, you know, looking at that kind of traffic, it really makes me think about different places and the commonalities between Phnom Penh, Abuja and Mumbai. They're all unique in their own way, but there's still those commonalities. So why aren't we talking about the things that all bind us together? We're on our way to work, we're, you know, we look after the children, we're on our way to education, you know, we need to be on a bus, why can't I afford a car, that kind of stuff. There's all those things that bind us together.
I earn my living by selling things to people at the junction and all that kind of stuff, and then the variation of what people are carrying in their vehicles, you know, cows stood on the back of them and you know, mounded high with sugar cane or whatever it is, or a whole family on a moto or something like that, you know. That's
and I always remember, you know, I think it was my first trip to Nigeria last year in August. Not my first trip, the first one was 20 years ago, but my first trip last year, and I'm standing in this lift. And this guy, it was late at night, and this guy got in. He looked shattered, absolutely shattered. He had a bag in each hand. And I said to him, oh, I like your suit, because obviously he'd made it himself, you see, obviously. And he looked at me, because then he realised where I was from, because he hadn't noticed me, really. I was just someone in the lift. And he was like, oh, where are you from? And I said, I'm from the UK. And then, as always, they like, you know, what's your favourite football team? So then you have to lie, because I'm like, I'm not interested in football. And then he gave me a business card. He said, if you ever need a suit and all this sort of stuff. And then I could have turned around and said, no, I'm not interested, mate. You know what I mean? Keep your card, give it to someone else who's going to buy a suit. And I took it. And he walked off ever so happy with himself, because he told someone about what he did and I'd noticed what he'd made. And you've just got to respect the hustle. Mm. Because, you know, they don't have the benefits of sitting around doing nothing because of a benefit system. You know, if they're not working, they're not eating. It is as simple as that, you know. And you can be irritated, upset, challenged, annoyed, all those things from people with disabilities hanging out at a junction, you know, knocking on your window, you know, begging or trying to sell you sunglasses or whatever. But if they don't do that, they don't eat. You know, and I think we've lost that in this society, which is there's always, we've got this safety net, which is marvellous. We've got the NHS, we've got the benefit system. But it also eventually, after 60, 70 years, breeds this, I need to do this to survive. I don't need to do that because I can survive. And that's a very different way of approaching life. You know? Fascinating, really. But that's why we should travel, because you're never going to get that from someone's YouTube video or from a soundscape. All of these things, they add to that benefit, and we still need to be challenging young people, particularly. You know, I mean, I still think, you know, this, you know, we've been talking about young people getting called up and doing a gap year with the army and all these sorts of things. Well, I think, you know, if that's what you're interested in, you should do that. If you're interested in community stuff, you should do that. But I think also the government should make money available for young people to travel just to experience the world. And you can either make that work for you or you'll come back and then work in McDonald's. But, you know, at least you've had that opportunity. You've not missed out. You've not missed out on that opportunity. I think one of the things as well about travelling is, as an old white bloke now, I'm going to be 60 in April, you get used to being responsible for so many things. I mean, everyone's like, oh, you know, some white bloke did this and some white bloke did that. So you're kind of used to being around groups of people that sort of blame you for everything, you know, which is quite funny, really. So I think one of the things that when you're travelling, and I had it when I was in Nigeria last year with at the Kaduna International Film Festival, where I was on a stage with five other people, and I'm the only white person there, you know, from Britain, and someone stood up and just went off on one about the British Empire and colonial times and all this sort of stuff, and quite rightly, everything he was saying was, you know, was absolutely correct, you know. And then rather than coming to me and saying, well, we've got a white guy sitting on the stage, he's from Britain, let's go to him for an answer, they went to everybody else on the stage first and then me at the end. And the only thing I can think of saying is, like, well, as the only white person in the room who's also from Britain, I feel eminently qualified to answer this question. And everyone just sort of started chuckling and laughing. And it was not to diffuse the situation, because it wasn't in any way challenging or negative or confrontational to me. There was no anger. Funny enough, there was no anger towards me, and I've never felt that anywhere that I've been. And that will come to a story I'll tell you next about India. It was just, we then had this conversation about Britain's role in Nigeria and systems that have been left behind and what the impact is. And I think people just want to talk about it.
Yeah.
And that's what it's about. Is they're not doing it to catch you out, and they're not doing it to make you feel uncomfortable. They're actually doing it because they want to have the conversation with you about that subject, because they might get it online, or they might have got it through education or through where they've grown up. But it's an opportunity to talk to you. You're one of those people that are quite abstract in the past, and suddenly you're in front of
and
them.
Also, and also the presumption that you are, that they're thinking about you, they're thinking about the British Empire all the time, is also, it's a myth told from the West.
Yeah.
That, you know, people in Southeast Asia are thinking about, you know, the French colonialists and, you know, whatever. It's like, no, they're actually thinking about Japanese, you know, the Koreans and the Chinese think more about Japanese colonialism than they do about European colonialism. So it's kind of like you there's an arrogance that kind of suggests that we need to adopt the sackcloth and ashes mentality all the time to excuse something which happened 200 or 300 years ago. And it's like, kind of, well, there's lots of things happened 200 or 300 years ago, but I wasn't involved in any of them. And now we're in place, take us at face value for who we are here and now. And that works both ways, absolutely works both ways. And it's like, kind of, what, when you hang on to your impressions of people that you've, the stereotypical impressions that you've grown up with, that are, you know, the biases and all that kind of stuff, that's one thing. But when you travel, it all goes out the window. Once you get away from the airport, I mean, there is that hermetic. I was watching a video the other day with one of these travel videos, and they were in a business class hotel somewhere, and it was like Bangkok or something. And it just looked the most boring place going. It was a homogenised, prepackaged experience. And Bangkok's become a lot like that now. The street food stuff's gone out there. You know, it's all in shopping malls and things, because there's a lot of money involved. and it's seen as progress, but at the same time you kind of go, you've missed the point of the freedom that you had, the chaoticness of what you had previously was such a contrast to the West, that it kind of gave you that, you know, it was a marked distinction between the two models. And now what you've done is you've turned everything into the same kind of homogenized, boring airport style, shopping mall style experience, and it's dreadfully, dreadfully dull.
Yeah, because you here, we like the idea of food courts, but then when you go to somewhere and you're expecting an authentic experience and they're serving you up a food court experience, you're just like, well, what's going on? You're saying, well, you're changing their culture. You're not going there to immerse yourself.
There's a video that went around with in China, and a chef washing, mops the floor, and then he cleans the mop in the wok. And as I was having a conversation with a friend, but they cook at such high temperatures that anything that went into that wok has been incinerated, you know. And they do, and it's like, yeah, you wouldn't do it here, but it's like, you know, what's your cultural reference point for this?
It's brilliant. Like. So someone said to me, oh, you know, how's your stomach, when I was in India? And I was like, oh, great, you know, I like eating with my fingers and you know, eating the food. And they're like, well, you know, what do you want? Do you want white chicken or do you want desi chicken? So I said, well, what's desi chicken? He said, well, more tasty. So all of this conversations around food, and it's like, well, do you want this or do you want that? I said, I want to eat what you eat. And they go, well, do you like this? I said, no, I want to eat what you eat. And I mean, I've come back now, I've been back a week, you know, and my stomach's been absolutely fine. And my answer when they asked me away about how I was doing with the food, I said, well, it's just lined with Nigerian food. So it's like, your Indian food can't get through the Nigerian food that I've got, you know. But I think it's just, again, it's that, if you go with that kind of mentality, you know, which is I'm just going to eat where those people eat, and rather than thinking, oh, that's dirty by my standards, or that's dirty by my standards, I have no idea what the back of a McDonald's is like, or a Pizza Express, or any of those things. So you get caught into, we've got better hygiene standards than there, but every single thing there is fresh. I mean, everything, you know, I mean, I probably didn't eat a single processed thing while I was away. You know, I'm back a week, do I feel more sluggish than when I was away? Yeah, probably because of the processed food. You don't realise that. And I think this is the other thing, you go with a preconception, or you can go with a preconception of what standards are like and what you're going to find. And I think you just need to be thinking about, well, just because their standards are different to yours, it doesn't mean that they're less. Actually, it's an alternative way of doing it that we've forgotten about, because we just think that that's the right way of doing it. Like you said, food courts and all this.
And one of the things to bear in mind, in the 18th and 19th century, when young civil servants went out to the empire, to Africa and India, two-thirds of them died from diphtheria and malaria. You know, it was like it wasn't this, say, you know, a lot of people suffered for whatever they perceived as the benefit of what they were doing. But it was like it was a real risk and a challenge. So it wasn't this easy thing. I mean, you know, to accommodate and integrate, you know, separateness from a Western perspective was essential. But now you travel insurance, you know, you pretty much get flown out of a, you know, if you do come set down with anything serious, unless you're really off the beaten path, you're pretty much going to get, you know, kind of expedited out of a medical evacuation if it's needed to the nearest big city, where you're probably going to be put in maybe even better quality hospital care than you get here in the UK. You know, it's like that privilege that comes with that travel side of this. It's like it doesn't have the same risks. You know, you're not cut off. You know, you just get on your phone and say, I'm feeling a bit queasy. So, you know, kind of, if you've got an upset, yeah, I had the, what's the polite expression for it? I had a deli belly. That's the phrase. I went through about six phrases and I thought they're not suitable for radio.
none of them are politically correct or broadcastable. But I mean, look, when I was in Sonalia, so we were in a Magnagar in Maharashtra, and it was a 7-hour drive from the airport. And that was a challenge, you know, off 10-hour flight and then 7 hours in a vehicle getting somewhere. That, you know, it's got a hospital on site, you know, it's got a school, you know, it's an incredible charity, NGO, and, you know, I'm proposing like a 3-year project to turn the original dome, which was way outside the city but is now in an industrial area, into a heritage centre and a museum. for their 40th anniversary. And so you realise that there's this kind of world within a world, because at night time you could hear all the industry, you could hear the trains, and, you know, you've got these street children, children rescued from sort of, you know, the sex trade and all that sort of stuff. It's there, it's real, it's ever present, and this is kind of miracle happens with people doing good things, and these kids are smiling and everybody's happy and everyone's doing sports and stuff. And I remember, I'm not really into, you know, for me, you know, people go there and have their Sonalia moment because of, like, you know, doing, I don't know, bracelet making with the kids, or doing things like, you know, playing sports and all that sort of stuff. And I'd not really felt that. So, like, 3 or 4 days in, I'm thinking, you know, I've become a really old, wizened, miserable, cantankerous
person. You've been around the block a few times.
Yeah, you know, I've kind of, you know, you can't woo me with, like, bracelet making. And I just remember they've got a place there called the Earth Studio, which was done by someone who's actually since passed away. And I kept going back to it, and it was always locked. And then someone said to me, oh, it's open on Sunday. This lady comes in and she does sketching. And I went in, and she was standing right down the other end with this bit of paper on the wall. And there was like maybe 6 or 7 kids. And they were just sketching, like a pot and whatever it was, a bucket and a pot. And I remember just waving at her and getting her attention. I said, can I come in? And she said, yeah. So came in, and this kid came up to me, gave me a pencil and a rubber, like, you know, an eraser. And I was like, I won't need the eraser. And he just looked at me and I laughed. And then later on, when I was sitting there sketching, I'd made a mistake and I was rubbing out. I looked at him and he just smiled at me and carried on drawing. And that was my moment. It was just like, it was the quiet. It wasn't the noise. It wasn't the laughter. It wasn't the smiles. It was just the fact that it was these 6 or 7 kids, and it was just, they were sitting there drawing. And I've kept it. I've still got the drawing. And I came out then, I was like, yeah, that was my Sonalia moment. And the lady there was walking back to her hut, and she saw me sitting outside my hut leaning against the door. And she said to me, are you all right, John? I said, I'm not sure. I think I've just had my, like, Sonalia moment. And she came and sat next to me, and we just spoke for like 20 minutes about what happened. And she said, normally people get this from doing stuff with the kids in the dining room, or, like, you know, doing bracelet making or playing sports. She said, and you've just had it, you know, doing sketching. I think because it was so quiet, it was really loud. You know, it's like that kind of deafening noise in the silence. And I think for me, that's when I thought, yeah, I'll do something for their 40th. Well, I needed to get a connection in order to do the Heritage Project. I can't just do it. You know,
the revelation on the road to Damascus, you know, is it an external experience or an internal experience? And actually quiet for us, you know, Leicester, living in the UK, living in cities, so full of noise, so full of movement and hustle and everything, finding those places of quiet contemplation, it's almost impossible. And I'm similar to yourself, I'm starved of places where you can go just sit quietly and reflect, because we don't have them. And it'd be, maybe that's one of the things that, you know, the dividing line isn't between the privilege of traveling and the for some people it's out of reach to ever travel. That's not the question. The real issue is contemplation and being overwhelmed with the world, and everybody's got to adapt to that.
So one final story for you, Rob. I was we got to this place halfway back towards Mumbai on my last day, and we went out and they said, oh, we've got this forestry set up here. We went to this guy, and I was going to interview him in, I think he was going to be speaking Hindi. And I said to the guy, well, don't worry about translating, you know, just ask him this and then just let him speak. And he was chatting away and he said, oh, are you going to do this? Are you going to do that? And then he said to me, blah, blah, blah. And then I heard the guy say in like Hindi, he was like, blah, 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 Britain, blah, 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 the British, blah, blah, blah. And I thought, well, here we go. I'm my last day, I've managed to keep away from it. This guy's going to get into me about the British and, you know, colonial India and East India Company and that sort of stuff. And he got up and walked off, and I was like, oh, here we go, what's going to happen? And he came back, and I've got this photo. It's a map. They've got all the records from 1878, I think it is, of the British going there and, like, surveying the forest. And he brought out this map from 1904 from the British, I wrote it down, British Forest Survey. Like, it was Lieutenant Colonel, you know, hyphen bucket, squeegee bucket. And he said, we still use those records and that from today. He said, so if, like, with the British being here, they helped to create this system that we can still monitor the forest. And he was absolutely positive about the impact that this survey had had and stuff like that. And so it was almost like a pleasant surprise for me, because I thought it was going to be like the British came and cut all the forest down. You know, which, that's what I was expecting, to build a fort or to do whatever, whereas in fact it was the complete opposite, which is these systems. And I think we are guilty, no matter where you're from, of the kind of the propaganda of your own history in the way that you're taught it, and either, you know, how marvellous you are, or how it's your fault that you go. And it's only then when you have a conversation with someone today that they can both, you can both interpret your own version of your history, and for the first time learn about other people, you know, impacts good and bad and positive. And I think for me that's one of the real benefits of travelling, is being able to go out there and constantly being prepared to challenge your own preconception of where you're going and your place in the world and your own country. And of course you get exposed to Bollywood movies on the plane and stuff, and you know, me and my mum have got into watching Bollywood movies at home. It's great. And like, you know, this sharp turn, look at the camera, hair moving in this, like, you know, breeze coming from left to right, and then the Indian flag waving in the background, and sort of, you know, Jai Hind, you know, India first, that kind of stuff. And of course it's interesting, because then America's going through this make America great again, America first, and then we've got Britain first and all this. And I'd be honest with you, I think because of education or lack of education, and because of the way our politics works and the way our mainstream media works, that a lot of people just don't know where they fit in. And sometimes if you're lucky enough, and I'm fortunate enough to go and travel like yourself, and if you, anybody listening gets a chance to go and do it, just find a way to go and travel, because suddenly what you realise is you find out more about yourself than where you're going, because probably for the first time you're actually learning about it and challenging yourself to do it. It's not in a classroom setting. No one's telling you what to think. No one's giving you facts. No mainstream media's telling you whose fault it is, and they're coming here to take our jobs and all that nonsense. And there's not a politician who's trying to get you to vote for them, so he's trying to whip up your nationalism from 500 years ago when someone did this to your great-great-grandfather or great-great-grandmother. So I think travelling's a very important thing.